Ontology is Overrated, Links, Tags, and Post-Hoc Metadata by Clay Shirky at eTech 2005, IT Conversations Program 470. Hello, this is Doug Kay, the host and producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you a presentation from the 2005 O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference. IT Conversations coverage of eTech is underwritten by GoToMeeting.com. GoToMeeting is the easiest way to organize and attend online meetings. GoToMeeting's 128-bit encrypted technology provides secure, instant, and hassle-free screen sharing, integrated conference calling, and web collaboration. IT Conversations allows you to test GoToMeeting for 30 days for free. Just go to GoToMeeting and remember the promotion code IT Conversations. And by MSMobiles.com. Mobile phones powered by Microsoft's Windows Mobile software offer unique features not available in other phones, such as .NET technology and the ability to run Skype in your PDA phone and use it over Wi-Fi. Daily news and many other resources about Microsoft-powered mobile phones can be found at www.msmobiles.com. And our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's our program from eTech.
What I want to talk about for the next 45 minutes, and the argument I want to advance and convince you of, is that a lot of what we think we know about I want to convince you that a lot of what we think we know about categorization is wrong, and that a lot of the ways we're attempting to apply categorization to the electronic world is actually a bad fit for the problems we're facing, because we've adopted habits of mind that are left over from earlier strategies. And that what we're seeing when we see the web is actually a really radical break with previous categorization strategies rather than an extension of them. When I am done with that, I also want to talk about what I think is coming instead. The second part of the talk will necessarily be less well-structured, because very often it is the case that old things get broken before people know what's going to take their place. Anyone watching the music industry can see this in work, can see this at work today. It is a rich irony of trying to talk about this that the word ontology, which has to do with trying to make clear and explicit entities in a domain, has so many separate definitions. So it's actually difficult to talk about ontology because there are so many alternate uses of the word. I'll offer two. The main thread of ontology in the philosophical sense is the study or delineation of entities and their relations. What kinds of things exist or can exist in the world, and what manner of relations can those things happen to? Can those things have to each other? In the knowledge management and AI communities, there's a similar. They've taken the word ontology and applied it more directly to their problems. Their ontology is an explicit specification of a conceptualization. The common thread between the two of those definitions is essence, isness. Right. In a particular domain, what can we say exists in that domain, and how can we say those things relate to each other? Now, anyone who deals with categorization for a living will tell you we can never get that perfect, but they have it as a goal. So the measurement of a categorization scheme is not do we get to sort of ontological nirvana, but how close did we come? So even though the schemes don't perfectly embody that, right, they still exist as a Platonic ideal. And what I want to argue is that even the ontological goal is the wrong goal. Even holding out that possibility leads to misapplication of categorization resources. So before I talk about ontology directly, I want to bring up a parable for our time. Right? Travel agents exist to distribute the interface between a handful of airlines and a large dispersed population of buyers, right? The railway center was in town. You could go to the railhead to buy your ticket. You can't go to the airport to buy your ticket. And so travel agents as a business sprung up to distribute this interface, right? The web comes along, which turns out to be a pretty good way of distributing interfaces, Right? And Travelocity says, hey, we can use that as a complete alternative for selling plane tickets. The travel agents, when they see this, say, oh, no, 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 of course we sell tickets, but we offer so much additional value. Right? We've built all of these higher order services on top of being travel agents. We offer people advice, we book other things, we help them pick which cruise lines to go on and so forth. It's not at all surprising that travel agents were making this argument. What is surprising is that the people who were destroying the travel agent's business were also making that argument. Travelocity, my company, Site Specific, 10 years ago, not my company now, but 10 years ago I worked at a company that had a contract with Travelocity. And we went in trying to help them become a better commodity supplier of what they did well. And the CEO said, no, 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 we're going to be adding value any day now. We're working on this application called Dreamcatcher. It was written in Java, which was the magic pixie dust of that era. Right? Sprinkle it on any problem and things get better. And Dreamcatcher was designed to do what travel agents did. Right? It was going to help people choose their cruise lines. So the surprise is that the people most responsible for destroying the travel agent's business thought of themselves as recapitulating what the travel agencies did rather than undermining it. So the old order, right? The categorization in the old order moved over to the new order with no one really examining it. And it took some time before people figured out what online travel, what Travelocity and Expedia were really doing was replacing the travel agency business. So that parable, I think, is related to what's happening now, which I'll bring up later. Classification schemes. Now to the main point. This is my vote for the best classification scheme ever, spelled with an A, of course. The periodic table turns out that by organizing elements by the protons and the nucleus, you get all of this fantastic value, right? You get both descriptive and predictive value. And of course, because what you're doing is organizing things by something that is as close to essence as it is physically possible to get. This is a really powerful classification scheme. It is almost perfect. Almost. Over here, all the way on the left-hand side, this pink column, I don't think it looks so pink with this projector, but this pink column is noble gases. Right? Noble gases is an odd category because helium is no more a gas than mercury is a liquid. There's really nothing about helium that makes it gaseous, but the people studying at the time didn't know that because they weren't able to make it cold enough to see that helium, like everything else, has different states of matter. So even in a nearly perfect categorization scheme, there are context errors where people are replacing something that happens to happen at room temperature and is absolutely unrelated to essence right in the center of the categorization. And there it stayed from the day they added it because we've all just gotten historically used to that anomaly. If it's impossible, even when you're doing something as elemental and physical related to essence as getting the periodic table of the elements right, in terms of the higher order categories. Imagine the problems faced by anyone who's dealing with an environment where the essences are even less obvious than this. Right? Which brings me to the subject of libraries. Right? If this is my vote for the best categorization scheme ever, libraries are probably the commonest. Right? The experience of the library card catalog is probably what people know best as a high order categorized view of the world. And all kinds of famous mistakes, right? The Soviet library system had as its first category of books the science of Marxism and all related literature, right? That's starting to look like a little bit of a dated assumption, right? Or this is perhaps my favorite. This is the Dewey Decimal System's categorization for religions of the world in the 200 category. Oops. How much is this not the categorization you want in the 21st century, right? So this kind of thing is rife through categorization systems. Here's the Library of Congress's history categorization scheme. Right? Top level, all of these things are co-equal in the Library of Congress's view of the world. I'd like to call your attention to the ones that are colored. The Balkan Peninsula and, you know, Asia and Africa. Just to review. Right? Just to review. Right, so we go from the minor problem of gases in the periodic table to massive elemental distinctions. Right, and yet, right, for all the funniness and ridiculousness, I was going to do Switzerland in the example, but when I did the graphic for that, Switzerland was just a red dot; you couldn't see it. Right, so what is being optimized here? right? The Library of Congress, no slouches in the thinking department, right? Founded by Thomas Jefferson. They have a staff of people who do nothing but think about categorization all day long. So what's being optimized here? It's not geography, it's not population, it's not regional GDP. What's being optimized here is number of books on the shelf. That's what the categorization scheme is categorizing. The essence of a book is book, right? The Library of Congress categorization scheme looks, right, the musculature looks like a high-order view of the world, which is hierarchical, it's non-overlapping buckets, any idea fits in one bucket and in no other buckets. But every now and again, the skeleton pokes through. And the skeleton is, that system exists to optimize linear seek time on shelves, right? The categorization scheme is built on top of the fact that people can't keep the location of more than a few hundred things in their mind at once. So once you own more than a few hundred books, you have to categorize them somehow. You could do it by height. You could do it by cover color. My mother, who was a reference librarian, said she wanted to reshelve the entire library by color because students would come in and say, looking for a sociology book, it's green. Right. But this imbalance here is a forced move because the real goal of the categorization schemes for things like libraries is to optimize the physical storage, not the intellectual aspect. It isn't ideas that have to be one place mainly. An idea can be all over the place. It is a book that has to be one place. And so the assertion that what libraries are doing, libraries and librarians are doing now, is essentially an uncomplicated extension of this work into the electronic domain, right? Underestimates, in my view, the degree to which what they've been doing previously is managing an entirely different problem, which looks in first order like it's the organization of ideas, but actually turns out to be the organization of the physical objects that contain the ideas. We've confused the container for the thing contained. Right. So the librarians, faced with this, say, no, all the higher order services we offer, that's what really matters. Right? The physical fact of the books is relatively unimportant. We're doing all these other things. As with the travel agents, that argument is not surprising. There is, right, you would always expect someone to argue for their own point of view. What is surprising is the degree to which, as with Travelocity, the people responsible for destroying that method of categorization thought they were recapitulating it. People have been freaking out about the virtuality of data for 30 years, and you'd think we'd have internalized the fact that there is no shelf, right? There is no physical constraint that's forcing this kind of organization on us, right? We can do without it. And yet, 10 years ago, a couple of guys out of Stanford, a little over 10 years ago, a couple of guys out of Stanford launched a service called Yahoo. And it was the first really significant attempt to bring order to the web. And as the web expanded, it grew into a hierarchy with categories, right? And as the web expanded more, and as they got VC funding, and they realized to keep on top of this, to maintain the value in their directory, they were going to have to systematize. And so they hired a professional ontologist. And they developed the now familiar 14 top-level categories, which go to subcategories. Each subcategory contained links or still other subcategories, and so on. And we have this link-managed world. So here we are in one of their top-level categories, which is called entertainment. And you can see in these categories, it tells you what the categories are. It tells you whether or not there are new additions. And it tells you how many links roll up under that category. Except look over here. Books and literature. It doesn't tell you how many links roll up under books and literature. Books and literature doesn't end with a number, but with an at sign. And that at sign is telling you that books and literature aren't really entertainment, right? We've put this link here for your convenience, but that's only to take you to where books and literature really are, right? To which you can respond, what's real, right? But in Yahoo's view, their ontology was realer than the user view, right? Yahoo is maintaining the right to say, we understand better than you how this is organized. So if you mistakenly think that books and literature are entertainment, right, we'll put a little flag up so we can set you right, but you have to go to where they are, right? My fingers are going to fall off if I describe this system too much more. You're going to have to go where books and literature really are to see how many links roll up under this category. So when you do that, right, you are told similarly that bestsellers are not really about literature. Because the list was produced through a commercial process. So bestsellers are really about commerce, right? So Yahoo, faced with the possibility that they could organize a world with no physical constraints, added the shelf back, right? They thought they couldn't organize the world without the constraints of the shelf, so they added it back, right? It is perfectly possible for any number of links to be in any number of hierarchies, right? But they decided to privilege one set of links over all others because they wanted to make assertions about what were real. And they wanted their assertions to be more powerful than my assertions as a user, right? The constraints of managing the library were what they wanted to be real rather than the desire of the user to find what they were looking for. And you can see how this maps to the worldview you would have as a technologist, right? This describes both a library categorization scheme and, obviously, a file system. The top level, subdirectories roll up under that. Subdirectories contain files, refer to the subdirectories, and so on all the way down. And both librarians and computer scientists at some point hit the same next idea, which is, you know, it wouldn't hurt to add a few links in here, right? Symlinks, aliases, shortcuts, whatever you want to call them. The Library of Congress has them as the second order categorization. This book is mainly about the Balkans, but it's also about art, or it's mainly about art, but it's also about the Balkans, right? Every hierarchical system that tries to subdivide the world is eventually pushed to this system. And then one of the things that Berners-Lee said is, you know, you could have a lot of links. Right? You don't have to have just a few links. You could have a whole lot of links. Right? And this is where Yahoo got off the boat. They said, get out of here with that crazy talk. Right? You can only have three links. Right? That's the Yahoo rule. Right? There's only three symlinks. And they did that in part because they didn't want to get spam since they were doing a commercial directory. So they put an upper limit on the number of symlinks that could go into their taxonomic view of the world. And they missed the end of this progression, right? Which is at some point, if you've got enough links, you don't need the hierarchy anymore. There is no shelf. There is no file system. The links alone are enough. And the reason when Google came along, it was adopted so quickly, right, is that Google said, there is no shelf. There is no file system, right? We are not going to tell you in advance what it is you need to know. I need every web page with the word obstreperous and Minnesota in it, right? You can't ask a cataloger in advance to say, well, that's going to be a reasonable category. We should encode that. So what the cataloger is going to say is, forget it. We're not going to optimize for that level of granularity. Google says, who cares, right? We're not going to tell the user what to do because the link structure is more complex than we can read except in response to a user query. So search versus browse represents an incredibly radical shift. Browse versus search represents an incredibly radical shift in your trust in link infrastructure and in the degree of power. Browse says the people making the ontology, the people doing the categorization, have the power, and they get to override the user's needs. And if the user wants something that hasn't been categorized in the way the ontologist said it should be, right, the user is out of luck. The search paradigm says the reverse. It says nobody gets to tell you in advance what it is you need, right? And at the moment that you are looking for it, we will do our best to service it based on this link structure because we believe we can build a world where we don't need the hierarchy to coexist with the link structure. It can be hidden, right? So a lot of the conversation that's going on now about categorization, we had some of it this morning, actually, in the talk about folksonomies, starts at the second step, which is, since categorization is a good idea to organize the world, dot, dot, dot. But question one is this kind of categorization a good idea? Right? And we can see, right, from the Yahoo versus Google example, that there are a number of cases where you get significant value out of not categorizing. Even Google adopted DMOS, the open source version of the Yahoo hierarchy. And then they downgraded it about a year and a half ago because no one was using it. Right? Offered side by side, search and categorization, fewer and fewer people were going to categorization over time. So the first question is this an environment in which an ontological view will work well, in which you are trying, as Stuart said this morning, to cleave nature at the joints, to make assertions in a categorization that map clearly to the real world? Right? Here are a list of situations in which that works well. Right? If you don't have a lot of stuff, if it's clear, if they're stable, if they're restricted, right? This is all the domain-specific stuff that you would like to be true if you're trying to do an ontology, right? The periodic table of the elements has all of these things. DNA has all of these things. Small, for some values, of small. What a lot of ontology ignores is what I think it was Joshua was talking about this morning, which is that there's a set of users involved, right? And the other question about ontology, almost never asked by the catalogers of the world, is what are the participants like, right? Very often you will hear people say, oh, well, you know, the users don't understand my ontology, right? And it's very clear whose fault the cataloger thinks that is, right? And yet, when we do head-to-head tests, right, we describe something and then we ask users to guess how we described it, there's a very poor mismatch, right? Unless the domain is so restricted and the participants are all experts, right, you have to learn to think in the same way as someone else. That actually takes a lot of instruction. DSM-IV is an absolutely classic example. Stuart mentioned it this morning. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which has now been through 4.5 versions, which allows psychiatrists all over the world, in theory, to make the same judgment about a mental illness presented with the same list of symptoms. There is an authoritative source for DSM-IV. They get to say what symptoms add up to psychosis. And they have both expert catalogers and expert users. Right? So the amount of people infrastructure that's hidden in a working catalog system, right, is as much a part of it as the amount of overt domain environment characteristics that make this sort of categorization work. Right? You can turn the list around. Right? You can say, well, here are some places where it works badly. Right? If you've got a large, ill-defined corpus, if you've got naive users, if your catalogers aren't expert, right, if there's no one to say authoritatively what's going on, right, the reason we know SUVs are a light truck instead of a car is that the government said they're a light truck. Right? They have the authority to do that. The reason we don't know whether or not Buffy the Vampire Slayer is science fiction is because there's no one who can say definitively yes or no, right? And so in environments in where there's no authority and no force that can be applied to the user, it's very difficult to support this style of categorization. This list is an almost perfect description of the web. Right? This list is an almost perfect description of the largest corpus with the most naive users. Right? The more you push in the direction of scale, spread, fluidity, flexibility, the harder and harder it becomes to muster either the expense of starting a cataloging system, the hassle of maintaining it, or the amount of force you have to get to exert over users to get them to drop their own worldview in favor of yours. A lot of the appeal of ontology is voodoo categorization. And voodoo categorization is, if I describe the world perfectly, then when I act on the model, the world will change, right? That's the SUV model, right? The SUV is a light truck because my acting on the model of what an SUV is changes its essence in the world, right? Most of the world is not actually amenable to voodoo categorization. And in particular, right, when we try to force that kind of categorization onto large user bases, right? We end up with two significant problems. The first is signal loss, right? This is a by now almost canonical example of the search and thesaurus problem. You see this come up on Delicious over and over, right? We need to enforce a thesaurus of terms, right? We need to enforce a thesaurus of tags. So if you tag something Mac and I tag it Apple and somebody else tags it OS X, we all end up searching for the same thing, right? And so they point to the signal loss from the fact that users, although they use these three different strings, are talking about the same domain. That example, beware when people circle around a canonical example because it's very often the outlier, right? In fact, right, as we start to expand this, right, movies, film, and cinema, I learned this from Brad Fitzgerald on LiveJournal. LiveJournal allows users to catalog their own interests. They make absolutely no attempt to enforce solidarity or a thesaurus or a minimal set of terms, no checkbox, no dropbox, just free text typing, right? Some people say they're interested in movies. Some people say they're interested in film. Some people say they're interested in cinema, right? And the catalogers first reaction, viewing that is, oh my God, that means that you won't be introducing the movies people to the cinema people. Good. Right? The movies people don't want to hang out with the cinema people, right? These actually encode different things, and the assertion that thesaurusizing or collapsing vocabularies deals with signal loss assumes that there's no signal in the difference itself, right? And when we get to really contested terms, right, politically contested terms, right, by this point, all the signal loss is in the collapse, not in the expansion. Right? Oh, well, the people talking about queer politics and the people talking about homosexual agenda, they're really talking about the same thing. Oh, no, they're not. If you think the movies and cinema people were going to have a fight, right? Right? You can't do it. You can't collapse these categorizations without some signal loss. The problem is, because the cataloger's worldview assumes the leverage of my cataloging or our cataloging outwards should have force on the world, they underestimate loss in the user population and they overestimate loss from the lack of centrality of terms. The other significant problem that voodoo categorization forces on distributed user bases is that it turns out, studies show, predicting the future is hard. Right? Alert readers will be able to spot the difference between sentence A and sentence B. Sentence B can get you in a lot more trouble. Woe betide the person who utters sentence B when what they mean is sentence A. Right? Sentence A is a statement. Sentence B is a prediction. But this is the ontological dilemma. Right? This is a book about Dresden. Right? This is a book about Dresden, and it goes in the category East German. And Stuart this morning said, well, you know, countries are these kind of uncomplicated categories. Completely wrong, right? East Germany turned out to be an unstable category. Cities are real. They are real physical facts. Countries are social fictions, right? It is easy for a country to evaporate. It is hard for a city to evaporate. So saying in some uncomplicated way, the small thing is contained by the large thing, you're actually mixing radically different kinds of entities. We pretend that country refers to a physical area the same way city does, but it's not true, as we know from the former Yugoslavia. There is a top-level category, you may have seen it earlier in the Library of Congress scheme, the former Soviet Union, right? The best they were able to do was just tack former onto that entire zone that they'd previously categorized as the Soviet Union. Not because that's what they thought was true about the world, but because they don't have the staff to reshelve all the books. I'm not kidding. That's the constraint, right? And when we re-examine categorization without assuming the physical constraint, either of hierarchy on disk or of hierarchy in the physical world, we get radically different answers. So, let's say you wanted to merge ontologies. And this is the classic problem. This is why people argue that users, even if they're distributed widely, should agree on terms so that later we can merge categorizations, right? So imagine we have two collections of books, mine and the Library of Congress's. Right? And you can tell this Library of Congress over here because they have a few more books than I do. And let's say that I magnanimously decide I'm going to grant my book collection to the Library of Congress. What happens next, right? Do I have to sit down with Dr. Billington and say, well, in my world, right, Python in a nutshell is a reference work, and I keep all of my books on creativity together, right? You say, well, there's books about art, and then there's books about creativity within art, engineering and creativity within engineering. I say, no, creativity is the top-level category. And do we have to go back and forth like that and hash that out before the Library of Congress is able to take my books? And the answer is no, of course we don't have to do anything of the sort. Right? They're able to take my books in while ignoring my categories because all the books have ISBN numbers, International Standard Book Numbers. Right? They're not merging at the categoric level. They're merging at the globally unique ID level. So my entities go into their categories trivially. But even more importantly, they can actually understand something about my methods of categorization by deriving my categories from my links. You start with the links and you build the categories around them rather than starting with the buckets and filling them in with the links. That way, when you merge, it doesn't have to be a nothing or all merge. It can be a partial merge, right? By examining where the links fall in these two different systems, you can actually derive a significant amount of overlap data that is probabilistic rather than binary. And this is what I think is coming. I think we're moving out of the world of crisp categorization and into organic categorization. Here is Delicious. This is Joshua Schachter's service, which we were talking about this morning. As you can see here, the characteristics of a Delicious entry are, here is the link, both the link and its attendant text. It's been given a set of tags. I don't know how well you can read them. There are a sample of some popular tags over here. Each user who lists it can give it a set of tags. Some do, some don't. There's the tag, the username, the number of other people who've tagged it, and the time. Right? Delicious is a social bookmark manager. It's for people who are keeping track of their tags for themselves, but who are willing to share globally a view of what they're doing, so you get this rolled up version as well. And when you look at the tagging on Delicious, this is a 2-hour sample of Delicious. The x-axis is the 64 users who posted links during that period. The y-axis is the total number of discrete kinds of tags that those users have ever used in their history on Delicious. And anyone who spends any time with social science data sets says, yep, that's it. That's the signature of an organic and unconstrained population. Right? There's a radical difference in tagging strategies. There's one person who has an enormous number of tags, right? And I don't know whether this person is having lots of material tagged with many different tags or is using tags to create what are effectively categories. You can build hierarchy in this system if you like. Then there's this group of people who tag quite a bit. And of course, this characteristic long flat tail of people. Now, because this is a 2-hour sample, it has a natural bias towards frequent Delicious users. Trying to get a larger data set, my guess is that the tail goes out quite a bit further than this. Right? But this is what categorization, or at least let's call it organization, looks like when you turn it over to the users, which is radically different strategies, each of which works in its own context, but which can also be merged. Right? This is a single user's tags. Right? So you can tell something about this person, right? Obviously a Flash programmer. The principal tag here is Flash. There are a number of tags. Again, the organic signature, right? Experts don't catalog this way. Experts who learn how to catalog, the clustering is much tighter, right? Here, it's whatever's useful to me in this context. And as Joshua said this morning, right, here's the tag to read, right? Again, the cataloger looks at this tag in horror, right? This is context dependent and temporary, right? Well, so was East Germany. Right? 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 Once you expand your time scale to include the actual life of categorization schemes, you recognize that the distinction between things that are context dependent and not, or things that are temporary and permanent, is a smear. Right? There isn't, in fact, a binary condition of a tag that can or cannot survive any kind of long-term examination. Right? And then this is to me, in a way, the most interesting and least well-understood part of the system. These are two different URLs and the tags that a whole group of users applied to them. The URL at the bottom refers to a site for downloading old versions of programs that are no longer supported. Right? And you can see here that there is broad communal consensus. 140 people tagged this software. Right? Then the next commonest tag, down with 20, I don't think it showed up here, sadly, but is Windows. Old, download, and so forth. Right? So there is a really sharp, clear signature. And at any place you put this shelf cut, right, you're either saying it's about one thing or it's about a long, flat tail. But it's almost a hinge. Whereas up here, this is something about embedding standing searches in Gmail. Right? So Gmail, Firefox, Search, JavaScript, GreaseMonkey. This is a much smearier tag. Right? So we can start to say of URLs with respect to user bases, right? The community either did or did not center around a certain collection of tags with this degree of certainty, right? And we move from the binary characterization, books are or are not literature, right? And we move into this probabilistic world. It may well be that within Yahoo there was a big debate about whether or not books are literature. But they either had no way of reflecting that debate, or they decided not to expose it to the users. And so what instead happened was, it became an all or nothing characterization, right? This is literature, this is not literature. And that, I think, is what we're moving away from, and we're moving towards being able to roll up this kind of value by observing how people handle it. These, I think, are the characteristics of organic categorization that we're moving to. As we get used to the lack of physical constraints, as we internalize the fact that there is no shelf and there is no disk, right, we're moving towards market logic. Joshua and Stephen and Stuart were both talking about this morning. Right? You deal with individual motivation but group value. As Joshua put it in the hall afterwards, right, each individual categorization scheme is worth less. But there are many, many, many more of them. So if you can find any way to create value from rolling them up over time, right, they will come to outpace professional categorization schemes, particularly with regards to robustness and cost. They're merged from URLs, not categories, right? You don't merge at the top level and then see what the contents are. You merge from the contents because we now have URLs as unique handles. You merge from the content and then try and derive something about the categorization from there. The merges create overlap, not synchronization, right? Joshua is able to recommend related tags by saying, well, a lot of people who tagged this Mac also tagged it OS X. So I'm going to say that these tags are somewhat related. I'm going to offer a guess. So instead of saying is not, is, right, we suddenly move to the Venn diagram option of kind of is, somewhat is, sort of is, overlaps to this degree. That is a really profound change in worldview for organization. Merges are probabilistic, not binary, as I said before. User and time are core attributes. This is absolutely essential. Right? The attitude of the Yahoo ontologist and her staff was, we are Yahoo. We do not have biases. Right? This is just how the world is. There are 14 things in the world. Who doesn't know that? Right? And you didn't know who that person was, where they came from, what their background was, what their political biases might be. Right? Look for the word queer in any top-level categorization. In fact, any categorization in the Library of Congress. You will not find it anywhere. Right? Even though, as an organizing principle, for a large group of people, that word matters enormously. Right? You don't get those kind of discussions around traditional categorization schemes. Here, because you can derive this is who this is from and this is when it was made, you can start to do inclusion, exclusion, you can start to do grouping, and you can start to do decay. Give me all tags with these signature, but anything that's more than a week old or a year old, right, reduce by this amount or exclude. Right? Roll up this group of users. I'd like to see what they are talking about, not the entire population, not just me. It's that those who do not know Unix, do not understand Unix, are doomed to reinvent it. Right? We've got right now user and world, right? And this is the base on which we will be inventing group. Right? We're going to start to be able to subset our categorization schemes. Instead of having massive categorizations and then specialty categorizations, we're going to have a line between them. The signal loss, and there is signal loss, the signal loss in this world comes from expression, not from compression. Right? The signal loss in traditional categorization schemes comes from the forced move of compressing things around the need to actually put the books on the shelf somewhere or to say that one link is a hard link and every other link is a sim link. Right? Here, when there is signal loss, it comes from people not having any commonality in talking about things. And so the loss is from the multiplicity of points of view rather than the compression around a single point of view. One-off categories are ignored rather than deflected. This is a classic web strategy, right? The filtering is done post hoc, right? It's like every journalist looking at the web and saying, well, it needs an editor, right? Well, it has an editor. It's everybody, right? If people don't point to it, other people won't read it, right? But the idea that the filtering is after the publishing is incredibly foreign to journalists. Similarly, the idea that the categorization is done by the user request, right, is incredibly foreign to catalogers. If people are trying to game the system and you set any kind of threshold for what do people think of this, how are they viewing this subject, right, those categories can simultaneously exist and be ignored rather than having to be shut out. Much of the expense of existing catalog systems is in trying to prevent these one-off categories. Here, what you say is, as long as a lot of people are cataloging it, these one-offs will be washed away at no cost. We won't even have to expend the cost to prevent people from using them. And finally, critically, and this is where I think the big debate is, the semantics here are in the users, not in the system, right? This is not a way to get computers to understand things. When Delicious is recommending tags to me, it's not saying, oh, OS X is an operating system. Therefore, if I know of software that runs on OS X, right, and I can sort of roll this over in predicate logic until I can come up with this, you might like this tag. What it's saying instead is a lot of users who are cataloging things OS X seem to be cataloging these particular pieces of software or using these other tags. It puts onto me the decision about whether or not Delicious's recommendation matches the semantics that I apply to the situation. So the overlap is in the system, but the semantics are in the users. This is not a way, and this is one of the reasons that people object to this system when they do object. This is not a way to inject semantics into the machine. It comes down, as Stuart said this morning, ultimately to a question of philosophy. Right? And this is one of the reasons the debates around here are so hot and at the same time, in some cases, so fruitless. Right? Does the world make sense? Or do we make sense of the world? If you believe the world makes sense, then anyone who tries to make sense of the world differently than you is presenting you a situation which needs to be reconciled formally. Because if you get it wrong, you're getting it wrong about the real world. If we make sense of the world, right, if we from a bunch of different points of view are applying some kind of sense to the world, then you don't privilege one top-level version of sense-making over the other. What you do instead is you try to find ways that the individual sense-making can roll up to something which is of value in aggregate, but you do it without an ontological goal. You do it without a goal of explicitly getting to or even closely matching the perfect view of the world. So it's all context-dependent. And I think we're starting to see with Delicious, with Flickr, with these other systems, ways of building these things that don't assume that the structured hierarchical categorization so often forced onto us by our physical systems is going to continue. Instead, we're dealing with a radical break where rebuilding around the URL and the flexibility of the link, we're going to get entirely alternate systems. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program recorded at the O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference held in San Diego, California during March of 2005. IT Conversations coverage of eTech is underwritten by GoToMeeting.com. GoToMeeting is the easiest way to organize and attend online meetings. GoToMeeting's 128-bit encrypted technology provides secure, instant, and hassle-free screen sharing, integrated conference calling, and web collaboration. IT Conversations allows you to test GoToMeeting for 30 days for free. Just go to GoToMeeting and remember the promotion code ITConversations. And by MSMobiles.com. Mobile phones powered by Microsoft's Windows Mobile software offer unique features not available in other phones, such as .NET technology and the ability to run Skype in your PDA phone and use it over Wi-Fi. Daily news and many other resources about Microsoft-powered mobile phones can be found at www.msmobiles.com. And our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. IT Conversations is listener-supported, so please contribute to our tip jar. 100% of your donations go to our team of volunteers who produce these programs for you in their spare time. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.